Namaste and welcome to the online Ayurveda Summer 2015. My name is Martin Kombrink from the Nanda Sangha Educational Institute, South Africa. If you'd like to purchase any of these audio recordings, please go to www.ayurveda-summit.com. Namaste. I'm very pleased and honored to have with me today Dr. Claudia Welsh. Dr. Welsh will be talking today on a very interesting topic which I can't wait to hear all about, and that's got to do with becoming the medicine we practice. Dr. Welsh, welcome, and I'm so glad that you can join us.
It's so nice to be here with you, Martin, and everybody else. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. So I'm not going to say much. I want to sit back and just listen a little bit to what you got to share with us today.
All right. Well, this is really a pleasure because this is the first time I think I've spoken on a summit like this about this topic, and it's interesting. Martin, I really appreciate the freedom to pick it, to choose a topic, and your enthusiasm about this one, because I've been thinking about this topic a lot. The topic is becoming the medicine we practice, and before I launch into what I want to say about it, I want to say a little bit about the resistance to this topic that I find in some places and also the enthusiasm about it. When I talk about this with people, there's a deep heartfelt enthusiasm that seems to be growing lately about this idea that, okay, we have all these medicines that we're prescribing. We are learning about anatomy and physiology and how these medicines interact with our physiology and our organisms. And we talk about the art of medicine. We talk about the mind-body connection. But using that in a practical way in our day-to-day lives with our patients, and might I even say, having not been in practice for a number of years now, with anybody we come in contact with, how are we having an effect on them? What is the art of medicine? And it's an interesting thing to talk about, because when we talk about science, we can talk about it in very grounded terms, whether that science is photons and electrons or whether that science is vata, pitta, and kapha, all of those kinds of physically oriented ideas and facts and data we're very comfortable talking with, no matter what modality of medicine we have. But when we start talking about the art of medicine, it almost seems gauche or impertinent, because it's so subjective and it sounds kind of woo-woo. And I mean, if you think about it, even when we start trying to talk about art in terms of the fine arts, we can start sounding or even being divorced from reality, in the sense that if you see a Picasso, you say, wow, that is beautiful. And then if you say, well, why is it beautiful? Then you start getting this kind of milk of magnesia voice that's very grumpy. And you start saying, it's beautiful because of this idea and that idea. And we're making stuff up. And I was approached a couple of years ago by Jessica Kingsley Publishers, and she asked, would you write a book about the art of medicine? And I said, well, let me get back to you in about a year. I don't know. I'm kind of busy. And I had it kicking around in the back of my head. And I thought, this is difficult, because the art of medicine is inherently difficult to describe, in the same way that it's difficult to describe what good visual arts are, what good fine arts are, and what makes that pleasing, and what makes that powerful, and what makes that healing, even to the spirit and to the body. And when you start talking, I mean, we all have had the experience, I think, in one time or another in our lives, of either the profundity that accompanies the experience of being a physician, or the profundity that accompanies the experience of being a patient, that doctor-patient relationship that is so deeply and profoundly moving and healing. We've all experienced that, but the second you try to talk about it, the second it starts sounding woo-woo, you know, it starts sounding etheric, and can we really become, is it really important to try to become well-versed in the art of medicine? Does it really make a difference? These are kind of things that were kicking around in my head before I finally answered about a year later, yeah, I'll write this. And once I wrote it, I turned it in, and she said, I really love it, and I don't know how to title it, because nobody wants to read about the art of medicine. And I think, well, now you tell me, you asked me. You know? But I saw her point, which, and she said, you know, people want to read about scientific ideas and therapies that are going to make our patients better, that are going to make and make us better as patients. So make patients better and make doctors better practitioners in terms of their scientific and therapeutic approach. But we're not all that interested in reading about the art of medicine, because how interesting could that be? But finally, we did hit upon a title, and this Becoming the Medicine We Practice is that one I wanted as a title. It ended up as a subtitle, but it's that's the difficulty with this. The resistance is that, is this real? Is this important? But the chord that I feel is really striking is this willingness on the part of real seekers to go into the unconscious of what's happening in a doctor-patient relationship, go into the, unpack the unconscious stuff that's going on, look at it, pull it apart a little bit, and put it back in, hopefully in better shape than we started. So that's what I want to talk about today, kind of unearthing what's happening in that doctor-patient relationship. How can we use that to the best of our ability? And we know that we can. And I'm talking about something that is not that's accessible to everybody, a way that we can approach medicine, that the approach in itself is therapeutic. So let me start in a little lofty way and then get a little bit more accessible with this, which is to say, I'm reminded first when I'm turning my attention towards this of a question that someone once asked my guru's guru. The questioner said, you know, Maharajji, what kind of medicine do you prefer? And they were thinking homeopathy, Ayurveda, because my guru's guru practiced homeopathy, and Ayurveda was, of course, the medicine in India that was being practiced, and they were also referring to Western medicine. And my guru's guru replied, I prefer the kind of medicine that Jesus practiced, where when someone touched the hem of his garment, they were healed. And I love this answer. Something would happen. Isn't that wonderful, Martin?
Sure.
And
absolutely.
And it's, you know, as gauche as it sounds to start looking at the art of medicine, it becomes even more pertinent to think that we can shoot for what Jesus did or what other saints did, that you know, people go to Amaji and feel healed. And but what I think we can do, and maybe that is gauche, and maybe we can't become that, but what I do think is happening all the time is each of us are affecting one another sometimes in very potent ways, either as medicine or as simply nourishment or as poison. If we have an interaction with someone, we walk away feeling better, about the same, or worse. And in that case, any one of us has the ability to act as medicine, as just a nourishing presence, or as poison for one another. And so I think we do have the ability to try to cultivate our medicinal aspect on each other, whether we're practitioners or whether we're patients or whether we're spouses or parents or siblings or associates. We can begin to have a medicinal effect on each other. And so that's what I'm looking at. And in order to look at this, I find it useful to, and this is where what I built the book around, is to look at these concepts from the frame. It's always useful to look at vague concepts like this, I think, with a structured format. And the structured format that I think works well for this, at least for me, is this idea that Charaka is one of the founding, not founding fathers of Ayurveda, but he's one of the, there's three main Ayurvedic texts, ancient Ayurvedic texts that are the authoritative texts in Ayurveda. And one is Charaka Sanhita by Charaka, a sage. And it dates, I don't know, thousands of years ago. And finding a real date for that is crazy and not really pertinent, so... but it's an old book.
Yeah.
And he he and also Vagbhat, the author of Ashtanga Hridayam, one of the other of the three, the Brihatrayi, the three greats, they both talk about, they both give us a little structure in which we can look at what it means to be an effective practitioner. And we could say a medicinal practitioner. And some of these, and they talk about four qualities that need, that a physician needs to cultivate in order to be effective. One is excellence in theoretical knowledge. Another is have extensive practical experience. The third is dexterity, which is an interesting point. And the fourth is purity. And when we look at how all of these relate to the art of medicine, it gives us some real insight into what's happening, I believe. Yeah. Because each one of them ends up yielding something surprising and wonderful if we really look into each of these, something surprising to this cultivation of becoming the art of medicine. And what, you know, we don't have a lot of time today to go into each one of these in depth. I do that more in the book. But to talk about these, a few points around these that I find really interesting are, if we take the first one, that physicians need to cultivate excellence in theoretical knowledge, when we really look into that and we really look into what is knowledge, we look at what Charaka says are valid forms of knowledge. He says authority, perception, and inference are valid forms of knowledge. And when we look into that, when we look into what authority really is, authority, according to Charaka, is a sage who sees the past, present, and future flawlessly. Who among us can do that, right? So that's kind of off limits to us. We also tend in these days to take as authority Western scientific studies, and those are incredibly flawed in so many ways and so vulnerable to manipulation. So that is a difficult place to put our trust in terms of authority. And we find out that we have a hard time finding real authority. And another valid form of knowledge is perception, and our own perception is constantly obstructed and clouded and influenced by the world around us and how we were raised. So that's a shaky ground in terms of knowledge. And inference is simply guessing. Inference is a fancy word for guessing. We're guessing at what's happening with our patients and what medicine might work for them. Doesn't matter how many studies we've read on a particular medicine or how many thousands of patients we've treated. When we sit down with a new patient, we honestly cannot know whether the patient that we see is a good match for them will have a good outcome or not. So basically, we don't know anything. When we're coming to the table not knowing anything, and yet the pursuit of knowledge yields confidence, it yields humility. If we look at humility as, which I like to do, as Lacordaire said humility was, is humility is not, I'm paraphrasing his quote a little bit, but he said something like, humility is not thinking less of ourselves than we are, but having an accurate understanding of our limitations. And when we really look at what our knowledge base is, we start to see, I don't know anything. That starts to give an accurate understanding of our limitations, which according to Lacordaire is humility. So the pursuit of knowledge yields, it can't help but yield confidence because we learn all these new tools, but it also concurrently yields humility. And both of these things end up having an important role to play in becoming medicine, because we can see all kinds of studies that show that patients trust confident healers. We also see, you know, pretty much everybody understands that if a patient has faith in a medicine, that medicine will work better for that patient, right?
True.
But what studies have found is even more important than the patient believing in the medicine is the doctor believing in the medicine. If the doctor believes in the medicine they practice, the results for the patient are better than anything else, including their belief. And I've seen this in my own practice as well. It's quite amazing. You know, I would have someone come in, usually a man who was very skeptical of this kind of medicine, and his wife had talked him into coming. This is what usually would happen. And so they were very skeptical. I never minded skeptical patients because I wasn't skeptical. And they would end up having a good experience and feel wonderful about it. And so my confidence was contagious in a sense. So the pursuit of knowledge yields this confidence that's contagious for the patient, that's healing for the patient. It yields humility, which is super important for the patient, because then we will listen. And especially we will listen if we pursue that other form of knowledge, which is perception, refining our own perception. And there that could be a very long conversation, but how are we really deeply seeing, hearing, feeling, communicating with our patients? And there are different kinds of communication. There's communication that's really intellectual, and communication that's emotional, and communication that's more, for lack of a better way to put it, prana-oriented, really getting a sense of our own prana, how it's moving smoothly throughout our body, our life force, how we are, the health of our own prana and emotions and being, and connecting to people on that level. And this may yield a deeper, more profound, more accurate representation of reality when we communicate like this than if we are just simply trying to gather data about our patients. So this pursuit of knowledge yields qualities, and perhaps especially compassion, because when we, the qualities that support this ability to become medicine, and I say it's compassion because when we deeply perceive a patient, we can't help but experience empathy, because when we're deeply experiencing a patient, we're focusing on them in a certain way as we focus on ourselves in the process. And mirror neurons are activated. There's all kinds of studies that suggest that mirror neurons were evolved in a sense to offer us an experience of empathy. We begin to not only perceive our patients, but to a certain degree become them. And that leads into a whole other, I know I'm talking a blue streak here and I want to make sure I don't overdo that, but it leads into this whole question of who is affecting who. Is your patient affecting you, or are you affecting your patient? And are we doing okay here, Martin? I'm really...
Absolutely, absolutely. Please carry on.
Okay. So take a little sip of water there. So I'll go to that a little bit in a minute in terms of who's affecting who. But when we start looking at these four qualities that we're supposed to cultivate as physicians, knowledge, practice, dexterity, and purity, what we start to see, I think, the take-home message in the final analysis is that the pursuit of each one of these, it may be impossible for us to have real knowledge. We may not know anything. And we may not have extensive experience, especially if we're starting out as a new practitioner. Dexterity, the ability to practice other kinds, is one way we have dexterity, is to have facility with other modalities aside from our own. Maybe we don't have that.
Siri not available.
I don't know. Every once in a while, my phone just chimes in. And purity, personal purity, is the fourth one he talks about, and maybe we can only achieve that to a certain extent. So in other words, we may not be able to perfect or master any of these qualities, and yet it's the pursuit of these qualities that yields humility, that yields confidence, that yields a greater ability to communicate with our patients, and yields compassion, and really ends up improving outcomes for our patients. So, you know, at the risk of going on too long, let me just talk a little bit about, if I may, about this who's affecting whom business. Do we have time for that?
Yes, absolutely. Please carry on. It's very fascinating, and I'm just listening to you here.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. So this, if we looked at knowledge really briefly, extensive practical experience we get over time dexterity we could talk about, but I think in terms of this conversation, this fourth quality he talks about, purity, is worth looking at. My guru used to talk about the difference between spiritual healing and simply healing as a result of, as a byproduct, as a side effect of having a pure character, purity in our beings. And it's worthwhile to have a distinguishing discernment there, in that we can say, okay, well, we may not become Jesus and somebody touches our garment and gets healed, and that's, you know, blasphemous even to say, probably, but what we can do is we can cultivate purity of character, and my guru said that in itself has an effect, carries an effect, and he gave many examples of this. In his own life, I know, I remember a story. Once there was a young boy who seemed that he was on death's door. He had many physicians had tried to help him, and it hadn't worked. And my guru went to him, and my guru maintained that what I'm about to tell you was not spiritual healing. It was simply a side effect of being treated by someone with a pure character. And So he went to the boy and he said, "You're going to be all right. You're going to take the same medicine that you've been taking, but I'm going to give it to you with my hand and you're going to be okay." And of course, it was. The boy was fine after that. And that's a difficult story to believe, that's simply a byproduct of pure character. But my guru told many stories like this, and I've heard many stories like this in both the East and the West. There's a story that I hear frequently about a vaidya, a traditionally trained Ayurvedic physician in Bombay, Mumbai now, but back when it was Bombay, who only treated with water. He would give his patients water and he would say a prayer over them. And he had wonderful results with water. Yeah. My guru there was a vaidya in his village who, traditionally trained, didn't go get a BAMS, a Bachelor's of Ayurvedic Medicine and Surgery, which takes 6 years to get in an Ayurvedic college. He didn't go to the college. He was trained traditionally and had a very small pharmacopoeia that he used, that he relied on. He had three medicines. One, I think, was a gourd, and there was two others, which I don't remember. And he would only treat with three simple medicines, and he got incredible results. And his son did go get the BAMS 6-year degree. And when his father passed away, he took over his patients, and he had this very big pharmacy, all these medicines that are fancy in India that we often don't have access to in the U.S., but asavas and arishtas and buttis, all kinds of tablets and things like this. And he didn't get very good results. And he went to my guru and he said, "Look, my dad got great results and I don't get great results. What's the difference?" And my guru said, "Your father had very pure character, and so his medicine carried that effect." So, you know, he was very clear about this. And when we look at these, at who affects whom, you know, there's a story, another story. In India, there's a story of a young boy who, his father says to him, "Look, you've been playing with this other kid. This other kid is very mischievous. I don't really want you playing with him anymore. I think he's going to give you a bad character." And the boy said, "Oh, no, father, I can play with him and I won't get affected. I'll keep my good habits." And the father said, "All right, well, see that coal over there? Please go get me some coal and bring it to me in your hands, but don't get your hands black." And the boy said, "Well, father, how can I do that? I can't do that." And the father said, "Well, in the same way, you can't play with this boy without having him affect your character." And it's a simple story, but it makes me wonder, what about the father of the other boy, the mischievous boy? Wouldn't he be wanting his son to go play with the good child to have the good effects rub off on the mischievous boy? So the question arises then, who affects whom? And should we then avoid everybody who's polluted and only hang out with people of impeccable character, right? We start getting this can start getting into kind of righteous territory, self-righteous territory. My guru told me once when I was seven, wrote me a letter, actually before I met him. And in this letter, he said, keep good company. Good company makes a man great.
Mm.
And one of the things that I think that as practitioners, I hear as a question many times is, how can I spend all day with my patients without getting affected in a bad way? So in other words, how can I act as medicine for my patients without my patients acting as poison to me? This is what we're saying, right, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and when we really look at that, so we're saying, okay, my patients are going to pollute me. They're going to tire me out by the end of the day. And this really becomes a question. And new practitioners and students often say, well, how can I protect myself? Can I have some kind of talisman or practice to protect myself, right?
Yeah.
And when we really look at this and see what are we looking at, this is when it comes right down to it, this is the way we're thinking about it. Are my patients going to pollute me, or am I going to heal them? How can that happen? And so then we go to, are we still okay with time, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. I will let you know, don't worry.
Okay. So when we do this, we can look at, there's a, I so wish I could remember where this quote is that I'm about to butcher and paraphrase for you. Every once in a while I read a quote and I think, oh, this is wonderful. This is going to be really helpful to me. And I write down what the source is and verse and text and so forth. And sometimes I read something and it doesn't mean that much to me then. And then I remember, then it starts to take on a life of its own. And of course that's what happened with this. And I have no idea where I got it. But it was some tantric book somewhere or another, and I'm going to totally butcher the phrase, but the sutra went something like this. It said something like, he with the deepest breath wins. You can tell that I'm paraphrasing that. That was my take-home message from the sutra, and it stuck with me. Like, what does that mean? And over the years, it has, I don't know what it meant, but over the years, it has come to mean this to me, which is, very often prana and breath are used almost interchangeably in the classics, but they're not the same. But I think that it basically translates as, he with the strongest pranic pattern wins. Mm. He who has the strongest pranic pattern makes the deepest impression in a community, in a sense that, here's another story. There's a courtyard, and my guru's guru has a bunch of disciples milling around the courtyard. Maharaji is not there, and this quote-unquote yogi comes into the courtyard, and he's for some reason fuming. I have a friend who was there, and he said he had never seen anyone so mad that they were literally frothing at the mouth, but this quote-unquote sadhu or yogi was frothing at the mouth with anger. And all the disciples got kind of paralyzed. They didn't, by this impression of this raging man. So in other words, his pranic pattern was stronger than theirs, and it dominated the scene. It colored the atmosphere. It flavored their experience tremendously, and everybody just stopped in their tracks. And then Maharaji came out, and my friend said he took his hands up over the top of the yogi's head and just ran them down the sides of his body as if he was draining the rage out of the sadhu. And the sadhu became like putty in his hands, just went limp with, just melted into pliability. And so in the first case, the raging sadhu had the strongest impression and that colored everything. And then in the second case, Maharajji had the stronger impression yet, and his experience colored the sadhu's experience. It was strong enough to color the experience. So if we have a strong enough practice in ourselves of keeping our own prana moving and our own health, mental health, and so forth, good. And I talk about this in the book, you know, in a little less lofty terms and getting into the nuts and bolts of it more. But if we are able to do that, if we have that stronger pattern, that may be the one that wins. But I want to suggest that we don't want to necessarily look at this as I'm winning over the patient, because then it sets up a hierarchy, a dynamic of I'm higher than you are. which we know isn't true because we don't know anything. We don't have perfect practice, and we don't have perfect purity, and we're not dexterous anywhere near the best we could be, right? So we're all walking around as pretty substandard practitioners, I think, in some ways. So we don't want to set up this "I am here to save and heal you" kind of thing. So what do we do? And I think where this is we go to a third possibility, which is we align with the Ayurvedya or an Ishta Devata or God or the divine, or the Ayurvedya being the divine embodiment of Ayurvedic wisdom. If we have studied Ayurveda or our medicinal paradigm of choice, we are feeding a body of knowledge that has been around for thousands of years, and we align with that body of knowledge, that divinity, because it is thought of as a divine embodiment of knowledge in India. If we can align with that divinity or God or whatever, if we align with that closely enough, we are giving permission, in a sense, for others to do the same because of mirror neurons, because of prana, because of this kind of mysterious but real interaction and relationship that happens, who is affecting who. If we're strong enough in alignment with that, it pulls everything into alignment with that. It gives permission for everyone to align with that. And that is available to everyone. And it's not, "I'm going to win over you." It's a partnership. Let us together align with this divinity. And that will encourage trust in both of us. It'll encourage confidence in both of us. It'll encourage humility and a sense of awe and purpose in both of us. And these are the healing things. These things have been shown over and over in Western scientific studies and Eastern anecdotes and everything in between, and in the healing and medical offices around the world. When something profound is happening, when those deep profound moments of transformation are happening, both for the physician and for the patient and for them together, this is what's happening, is we're aligning with this thing that is bigger than me, bigger than you, and is healing. So I think it ends up allowing us to become the medicine we practice, and I think it has a profound effect on making the science more effective.
Fantastic. Dr. Wells, that is absolutely astounding and different way of looking at it, and it's all things that you mentioned that we know. We have to keep the good company. You know, all the saints and sages have been saying that. The greater the world, the greater the flow of energy. So if we have that prana, that flow there, and we can transmit it and pass it on, and we can connect with the divine or whatever it is, as you said, then we just align not only yourself, but the patient, and healing takes place spontaneously. That's it.
I think that it's even when we're in simple interaction with each other, when anyone is in integrity, deep integrity in ourselves, it gives a permission to others to do the same. And that deep integrity is not saying something or doing something when we don't feel like doing it. It's not saying one thing and feeling another. It's not, the Gita talks about the fact that it is more important to live in our own dharma, even if it means death, than to try to live someone else's dharma. They say that at one place, and another place it says it's better to live in our own dharma rather than someone else's, lest we breed fear and insecurity. And this is what I think living the dharma is. It's not, what's my dharma? It's not something we get to decide. Oh, my dharma is to be a healer, or a butcher, or a baker, or a candlestick maker. It's not, we don't get to decide our dharma from here and what we're going to be doing in the future. It's not what we do. It's who we are, and it's what shows up at each moment. And the only thing we have to decide is whether we will live in alignment with that rightness, that clarity of the moment in any given moment. And when we do this, it allows the prana to move smoothly in my experience, and it allows a sense, a profound sense of permission and relief to others to do the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also we're talking about this prana, when you're connected with it, that when you sit with a patient and they come for whatever reason they come to you, whether it's physical, emotional, or mental or spiritual aspect that you're dealing with, that you then are able to tap into the Akashic almost intuitively and really just decide, and something says, no, I must try this, and this was what's going to help the patient. Something maybe completely different why they came to you, but that insight, where does that come from?
That's right.
You know, then that's what the, I think what we're talking about here.
That's right. And everybody, you know, seasoned practitioners always have that experience. And,
yeah.
We might have this idea, oh, there's this whole other remedy that would be work for this patient. But even the regular remedies, what we're not necessarily thinking back to all our years of study and what is the rasa virya vipaka of this medicine and that medicine, and what is the appropriate medicine for, we're not thinking about it in a very logical, sequential way. It's something that comes to us, even trifala, even the basic things often will just come to us. You know, in the same sense as diagnosis, you know, the diagnosis will just come to us. It's not something we reason out after a while. It's something we see as a collective initial intuitive experience, like, oh, this is what's happening with this person. And that is, I think, in direct relation to this alignment with the Ayurvedya, we could say, for lack of a better way to put it, perhaps.
Yeah. Absolutely. Dr. Welsh, you spoke about, you keep referring to all these aspects that we spoke about in your book. And which book is this that the listeners can go and read up more?
Yeah, well, it's not out yet. The due date is August 21st.
August
2015. Okay. And the title is How the Art of Medicine Makes the Science More Effective, Becoming the Medicine We Practice. So okay. It's quite a mouthful, and in fact, okay. I wanted the Becoming the Medicine We Practice to be the title, and How the Art of Medicine Makes the Science More Effective to be the long subtitle. But right. The publisher won, and the publisher is wonderful, and they know what they're doing.
Go with the publisher.
Yeah.
Now, besides the fact that you're also Ayurveda specialist and all this, you're also a doctor of Oriental medicine, right?
I am, Martin. I practiced it quite extensively for about 13 years. But in the last number of years, I have closed my practice because my teaching and writing and traveling has picked up enough that I can't be present in a practice the way I know from myself is best to work with people. So I do, but I'm not practicing either one anymore in terms of in an office situation.
Sure. And then you also well versed in Jyotish, in the Vedic astrology.
I've studied Jyotish, you know, it's all relative, right? So a lot more than some and a lot less than others, and I've studied it enough to know how vast it is and how much I don't know. And so I use it in my personal life, and I used it in my practice many times when I would hit a wall with something. And it really would serve me well in those situations. But I'm certainly not a teacher or practitioner of Jyotish in the sense that I don't do readings for people formally or anything.
Sure. We also very blessed to have, Dr. Svoboda, who's also a part of the summit, is going to come and talk specifically on Jyotish and the relationship to Ayurveda, which will be very interesting.
Wonderful. Well, that should be really fun. And he's you may know that he's a dear friend and colleague of mine. And
yes.
That is probably mostly where I talk about Jyotish is when we get together and talk about various people's charts and things that, you know, that kind of level. So it's more of fireside chatting.
Okay. And then tell us a little bit more about the nadi theory in pranayama that I mentioned earlier.
Well, you know, a lot of people find, you know, there's different nadi theory, and people get into it in different, deeper or less deep ways. And the way I talk about it, and where I really love to work with that is in very, I think, very simple ways, nothing super complex, but right. But to me, it's been one of the most profound medicines that I've known, is to work with the nadis, and especially Ida and Pingala, especially with a very, very gentle but super effective nadi shodhana, alternate nostril breathing. When we look at what that means, the nadi being the channel and shodhana being the forcible expulsion of dosha, when we do nadi shodhana, we're forcibly dredging out the obstructions from Ida and Pingala. Ida representing the Brahmana, or building and nourishing aspect of the being, and Pingala representing the Lungana, or the lightening, the reducing aspect of life, the stimulating, motivating aspect. And this is a duality that the body functions within. You know, the body is functioning always in this very narrow realm between extreme opposites, you know, extreme cold on one hand, extreme hot on the other, and 98.6 right in the middle, you know, and a few degrees colder or hotter, and we're very sick, and a few more degrees, and we're dead. You know, we have this very refined organism that relies on a very sophisticated balance between extremes, and Ida and Pingala represent extremes in the body, and in the pranamaya kosha and the anamaya kosha, the manomaya kosha. And so when we work with those, it's a very powerful tool to support that refined balance.
Yeah. Isn't it just amazing that you can use nadi shodhana? And for me, it just works like that it focuses your mind and just puts you in that balanced state almost immediately if you just work with it. It's a fantastic practice.
It is. And it's one of the most powerful medicines for hormonal balance It is the most powerful medicine for hormonal balance I've found. If I was going to have to pick one, it would be that. You know, and I have many, many stories of women who were going through menopause, having a difficult time, and diet and lifestyle and herbal remedies worked up to a point, and then they started to do Abhyanga, and that helped more, but then nadi shodhana is the thing that blows everything else away. It's tremendous, and there's many reasons for that are interesting and deep and powerful, and simply presented in the texts, but then when we really get into them, they're profound. And I think, you know, this is the thing, Martin, is that, you know, it's so tempting to think that all these complicated remedies are where the real healing is, but I believe so deeply that the powerful, subtle remedies are in the simple things. They're in what we overlook because we think it's just too simple and too good to be true.
That's right. Maybe we should move back to the three remedies or three things that we're working with instead of all these hundreds of remedies that we're trying to work with.
I believe so. And part of that is because of this, the fact that Ayurveda works, you know, Ayurveda works with the five elements and the three doshas, but also another equally powerful and in many times more powerful way of looking at things is through duality, the Brahmana Lungana kind of duality, which is analogous to yin and yang, exactly analogous to yin and yang. And it's a very powerful way to approach reality from an Ayurvedic perspective. And when we do that, we treat, of course, hot with cold, we treat light with heavy, and we would treat complicated with simple. So in the complicated world that we live in, with complicated emotions and complicated work and complicated affairs, we're craving simplicity. And so, yes, preferring those three simple remedies to the pharmacopoeia of complicated ones is not only a lot simpler and cheaper, but it's a lot safer. And it's a lot easier on the Earth's coffers because, you know, we're taking too much from her.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Welch, now, please just share with us how you actually came to meet your guru. It seems like you were in India for a long time. You mentioned something that he was actually communicating with you even before you met him. Just share with us a little bit. I love these stories.
Oh, they're great, aren't they? Yeah, the stories. We all love them, you know. When I was 4 years old, I met my guru's guru, who had come to Boston in 1972, and we didn't talk. I saw him in a big room. I was three. I was about to turn four in a couple months. I don't remember anything else about being three, but I remember him very clearly. He was a mountain of a man. And whether or not this was coincidence or cause and effect, over the next few years, I had moments where I had a very strong desire to know who God was and what God was. And he passed away in 1974. And in 1976, a dear friend of mine went to India and found him, found the successor, and came back and told a number of us, "Oh, I've found this man. I believe he's the successor to the previous guru, and I'm going to go back and see him again." And I don't remember asking him if I could. I don't remember the conversation, but I ended up giving him or one of his friends who was going with him a letter to bring from me. And this letter, of course, was written in my hand, and I was 7 or 8 years old at the time. And so it was written in a child's pen. So clearly it was from a child. But when they came back from India some weeks later, or a month later, something like that, when they came back from India, they came back with a written reply from my guru, who I got initiated when I was 11, but so I hadn't met him yet. But I had this letter, and this letter was, though clearly my letter had been from a child, this letter was not to a child. It was to a soul. It was not written as to an 8 year old. I still have this letter, and it's my, I would say, most cherished possession. And what it says it still guides my life and supports it and enlivens it to this day. And then he, some months later, when I was eight, he came to visit. And so I met him then and fell quite in love. And it's a nice time to meet a guru 8 years old, because it's sure. Before the intellect kicks in, you know? So yeah. It's just love. And then the intellect kicks in later and makes a mess of things. But that's important, too, because we have to get the intellect on board, especially if there's any pitta involved.
Yeah. Amazing how our life laid out for us, and how it just happens that we do need to have these special people coming in our lives just to put us in a specific direction, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, that direction just seems to clarify over time and space, you know, just those words that he wrote to me, "Keep good company makes a man great." I think that they've formed my life in ways that I certainly had no clue about at that point. You know, I started going into Ayurvedic medicine thinking, oh, this is so, I love this. I love Ayurvedic medicine. And I love the knowledge. I was in love with knowledge, which of course we've determined that we don't really have, but I was in love with the pursuit of knowledge and in a sense, I don't know if I was seduced by it or enamored with it or in love with it, but I was pursuing it. And many, many, many years later, and in fact, let's come to today, what it seems to me is the case is that it's not Ayurveda that I love, it's good company. And Ayurveda has been a vehicle for me in my life to enjoy good company, whether it's been the teachers I have been incredibly fortunate to study with, or the now students and colleagues, and the thirst of the average Ayurvedic student and practitioner for knowledge and love combined, not only knowledge but knowledge and love, is a unique situation in medicine. And in some ways, I think in part because Ayurveda is not yet anyway licensed or certifiable in legally in many Western cultures. And so when we come to study it, we have no idea what we're going to do with it. So we sacrifice money and time and effort and in some cases lives doing something we have no idea where it's going to bring us, because so many people, you know, I ended up with a degree in Oriental medicine, and that allowed me to practice legally and have a lot of clinical experience, but not everybody is able to do that or chooses to do that. And in any case, when you study it, you never know where Ayurveda is going to bring you. And there's this adventurous spirit to studying it. We don't know what we're going to do with it. And yet there's something that draws us. And I would suggest it's perhaps more than the pursuit of theoretical knowledge, but also of love. And we find these connections that are so enriching all over the world. And we feel like we're coming home to something at the risk of, again, sounding divorced from reality or woo-woo or too esoteric. I believe this brings Ayurvedic students together and to Ayurveda, this love in a sense, and so we end up having quite beautiful company.
Absolutely. And with that, I think we must call it a day, because I feel I normally ask, what is your vision for Ayurveda? But I think you've already summed it up for us. You know, this energy, and will attract the people, like when the student is ready, the master appear. And similarly, I just feel Ayurveda is out there for people who are really sincerely looking for something for whatever reason. And it's such a powerful energy and history behind it, with all the Advaitas and everybody else, that it is truly a transmutable force of healing.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. And we have a choice, you know. We have a choice of whether, in a sense, we have a choice to the extent to which we have choice. We have choice to have a medicinal effect or a poisonous effect or something in between on our environment and on who we're with. And this is a weighty charge to take on. But if this is what we want to do, I think that there's support there to do it. And we do have the ability to refine the medicinal aspect of the art of medicine.
Absolutely. Dr. Wells, please share with the listeners your website address, where they can get hold of you, maybe some of your books, signing up for your newsletters, or even some of the e-courses that you offer.
Certainly. Most everything that I'm going to say is found on my website, which is www. And maybe you don't need the W's anymore. I think I'm dating myself. Dr. Claudia Welch. That's WELCH.com. And I have two books. One that's out that you mentioned, Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life. And the second book is the one we've been talking about today. How the Art of Medicine Makes the Science More Effective, Becoming the Medicine We Practice. There's an advanced introduction to beginning Ayurveda online course, which hopefully will be up by November of this year, 2015, or early 2016. It's a course that Dr. Svoboda and I have put together, and it will be a video course. There's a course that I love called Healthier Hormones, which you can access through my website, that is hosted by Kate Stillman of yogahealer.com. And It's a course that predominantly women take it, but it's for anybody in terms of, we're ostensibly looking at balancing hormones, and it certainly does that, but I think it's far more healing than just about the hormones. So it's about for anybody support in terms of supporting a healthy daily life, but in a fun way. That sounds boring. It's fun. It's interesting. And it has a worldwide community of support to make changes in life. So I really love all of these different projects, and they've been meaningful to me, and hopefully meaningful to others. And anything else that I've missed? The newsletter. I try to not bombard people with a newsletter, so I send one out seasonally. So about four times a year, and you can sign up for that on any page of my website, drclaudiawelch.com, and that lets you know what I'm up to and where I'm speaking and so forth.
Wonderful. Dr. Welch, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here. And from my side, and all the work that you're doing, contribution to Ayurveda, but also in general, just to uplift humanity, may you be blessed. You're already blessed with the presence of a guru. But may you just continue to grow and to fulfill your highest dreams. So namaste, and thank you for that.
Oh, thank you so much for that wish. That's beautiful. And all the best with your endeavors too, Martin. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for being here. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to all these wonderful speakers. If you'd like to purchase any of these audio recordings, please go to www.ayurveda-summit.com. Namaste.